You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And I'm Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate today. Stacey Parker Aub was 18 when she started an internship in President Clinton's White House. For 3 years, she worked for George Stephanopoulos. Then in 1997, she became Paul Begala's special assistant. Initially, it seemed like the ideal job for an idealistic young woman. Then in January of 98, everything changed with the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Stacey's book, Government Girl, Young and Female in the White House, is a frank account of the difficulties she faced navigating the unwritten rules of the White House, and it also details the joys she had while on the job. It's published by HarperCollins. I'm pleased it brings her to the show today. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So when did you start working at the White House as an intern?
Oh, I started in the spring of 1993.
And you were a George Washington student, an undergrad?
Yes.
How'd you get the idea that you'd want the job and that was even available and attainable?
Well, it was wonderful going to school at George Washington University because literally my freshman dorm was 3 blocks away from the White House complex. And so when the president and his team was preparing their inauguration, they actually set up their offices in our student center. So I was able to walk in and say, I'd like to help out. And they took me in as a volunteer. And by working hard and you know, having people like you, they asked me to come into the White House and volunteer as well.
Now, were you too young to actually vote for him in the November election? Were you 17 then?
That was my first election. My birthday's in June.
And you didn't even question it. You were definitely going to vote for Bill Clinton.
Yes, I was a Clinton fan since senior year of high school.
And you grew up in the Detroit area.
I was born in the city of Detroit, but then after my father passed, we moved to the suburbs. So I was in Troy, Michigan.
So your first job at the White House, and this is what people do in their first job, you were answering fan mail. Tell me about the kind of mail that George Stephanopoulos would get.
Oh, you know, the person I worked for the most was Heather Beckel, who was George's assistant. And I think she saw me as a savior almost because I was going to come in and help her with these mounds and mounds of mail for George. He would get all kinds of mail. He'd get people who wanted dates, people who had a granddaughter they thought was perfect for him. You know, can you come to our church picnic? But then also there were people who had real policy concerns and you know, real issues. And they would write the administration thinking that he was the person who could help them.
Now, did you feel like you were doing an important job? You're answering these people's questions, or was the importance of your job that you're taking these distractions off the plate of George Stephanopoulos?
We really felt that it was important to write back everybody and write back as specifically as possible. Yes, we were helping George with all that backlog, but we really felt like we were speaking to each voter and letting them know they were being heard.
And from everything you wrote in the book, it seems like Stephanopoulos was exactly, he comported himself perfectly and was a very calm and soothing personality in your presence, never stepped over any lines, just kind of a perfect guy. And you didn't really get to know him that well, but maybe that's as it should be with a boss and an intern.
Sure. You know, it wasn't until I read his memoir did I even know that he was having real problems working there, that the stress was really getting to him because you never saw it in the office. You know, he never raised his voice. He never threw phones. You know, he wasn't as energetic and flirty as some other people.
Well, I don't know about flirty, but energetic and throwing phones, that describes Rahm Emanuel, who you had a lot of dealings with too, right?
Right. I write in the book about how I had a huge crush on Rahm Emanuel. You know, I was 18 coming in, and I just thought, you know, he was everything.
Yeah, I think you're right about, wow, he was a dancer and also served and maybe killed some people in the Israeli army. And kind of like that. But Rahm was a friendly guy, too?
Definitely.
And there's actually a picture online on your website where you look very different than you do today of it was your birthday, your 19th birthday, and you're shaking President Clinton's hand.
Yes, it... You know, this really kind of shows how much of a kid I still was when I was there because I was so excited. It was my birthday. I was going to be in the West Wing. And, you know, I have this chapter where I'm talking about how it felt like the movie 16 Candles,
right,
when people forgot Molly Ringwald's birthday because no one had remembered my birthday that day, and I was so disappointed. But then it turns out Heather did remember it, and she brought me into the Roosevelt Room where the president was giving his radio address, and I was able to meet the president.
Which is a lot better than Anthony Michael Hall, who Molly Ringwald got in 16 Candles. Right? A little bit of an improvement.
No kiss over the cake, though.
No. Had you met him before? What kind of interactions would an intern or any intern have with the president?
If you were lucky, maybe you saw him walking around in the hallway. Probably you didn't see that often. You're probably just working somewhere. Occasionally, you might be invited to go to an event where maybe you're on the rope line, maybe you were close.
Right.
So this was pretty unique.
Right. And the other interns you dealt with, especially with the president and other high power people, they had a very distant, an appropriately distant relationship for the most part, it seemed to you.
Definitely.
You know, the book's also, it's a memoir of your first job at the White House, but it's also a memoir of your first real job in a workplace. You know, it could have been any workplace where you go through the thing like, what's a fair request from a boss? What's an unfair request? Looking back as an adult, do you say, I can't believe that that was the setting in which I cut my teeth?
I definitely think about that all the time. It was, you know, I felt like working in the White House was a wonderland because I was surrounded by these incredible professionals, these superstar politicos, Secret Service agents, and White House press corps. It was very exciting. But on the flip side of that, I was always in fear. I was always afraid of making a mistake. I felt that if I screwed up anything, be it, you know, the coffee or getting a letter wrong, that that could spell the end of my political career. Because you think about it, you've reached the top ranks, you're surrounded by the top ranks. And if all of a sudden someone doesn't like you, then, you know, where are you going to go from there?
Right. And then the, you know, then we, I think a lot of what informed your time at the White House is the circumstances in which you grew up. Of course, that would inform anyone. But tell us a little bit about that. Your dad, I think you mentioned, he died young of alcoholism, essentially. And you always felt like an outsider in your community to some extent.
I did. I think this is part of why I became so interested in politics. I was born in the city of Detroit. And I lived there until I was six, and I think you could characterize fairly my childhood as pretty unstable. My father was dying of alcoholism, basically drinking himself to death. And, you know, my mom, she came from Kansas. You know, basically she was this white girl in the city. You know, my dad was black. But she was dealing with it, and we moved around a lot, My father passed when I was six. My mother remarries, and we end up moving to the suburbs. And on the great side of that is all of a sudden my life became very stable. I was able, you know, I was in great schools. I got attention from my teachers. That was great. But the flip side of that is I often felt very invisible. I was this brown girl in the suburbs. It was weird because many of the little towns I lived in was mostly white ethnic Catholics, and it was just, you know, this is the early 80s, mid 80s, and I realized that, you know, people didn't talk necessarily in Detroit. It's very segregated. And I realized soon that, say, in my suburban high school, if I didn't speak up for, say, my people in the city, no one else was going to speak up. So I learned quickly that you have to speak up. You have to get involved. And I thought, you know, government, that's what I want to try. That's the way I want to try to right wrongs out there.
And, in fact, you could take a drink of water because I sense that you maybe need one. You thought that maybe a career with the CIA. In the beginning of the book, you say that when you wound up working on the advance team for the president, people would see you passing and they say, who is this Middle Eastern person? Who is this? You know, maybe you have an ethnicity that's hard to peg, so you thought maybe you could use that as a CIA operative or something like that.
Well, it's funny. My senior year of high school, I received a letter from the CIA where they were trying to recruit, you know, people of color to come in and work in the CIA, and they'd pay for your school and you committed to time afterwards. But I remember sitting there in that classroom reading this letter, and already, you know, I didn't have an in-depth understanding of the CIA's history, but I knew enough to fear working in a scenario where, you know, like the image I had was that I'd be in a Central American jungle and Ollie North is in the helicopter and he leaves me behind and there's fire all around. Like, I would just be abandoned by, you know, my government.
As personified by Ollie North. Yeah.
maybe because, you know, I'd already had some, you know, issues of, you know, being abandoned before. I didn't want to be abandoned again.
Right. Now, but it was what, an FBI background check, not to work for the FBI, but they do the check for you that not was your undoing, but did trip you up because you gave them different answers. Tell me the circumstances with that.
This was really my worst experience in Washington, but also the best one because I learned the most important lesson. You know, when you work in the West Wing, you have to undergo an FBI background check. And I went through it twice. I went through it when I was 18 and when I was 23. Now, when you do it, you have to answer questions about drug use. So I remember coming back, I'm Paul Begala's assistant. It's 1997. I'm doing the test again, and I'm so excited because I'm being totally honest about my answers. I'm being very accurate and honest. And I'm thinking, okay, the consequences, you know, be darned if anything happens. And so I turn in the forms. A few months later, and we're already in the Monica Spring at this point.
And we'll get to that in a second.
I get a call from the counsel's office, and they tell me to come down. And at first I'm thinking, it must be for Paul, because he's always dealing with the counsel's office. And it's like, no, it's for you. And I come down. And, you know, there's FBI agent and a counsel, and they're like, you know, you had conflicting answers on your background check, and this is a problem. And it was the worst panic I'd ever known.
And what it conflicted with, they meant that when you were 18 and filled out the same forms, you denied drug use.
Well, here's the thing. When they confronted me with this, I couldn't remember how I answered it.
Right.
And it was like that part of my memory had shut down. Like, the fear had drenched it. I don't know what happened. Because all I could think of was, I was so honest this last time. What's the problem? And, you know, I had to come back. And, you know, luckily, when I came back, I still didn't remember what happened, but I said, here are my honest answers. They gave me a stern warning, and they let me go. But for that, you know, for that 24 hours, I was facing charges of lying to federal investigators, to possibly losing my job.
Wow.
in a really shameful way. But the thing is that I was lucky because I had such support from both, say, my mom, and also from Paul Begala. I felt...
So you talked to Paul about it? Did he say, Paul, here I am, on a first-name basis, but I'm sure you were. did he say, I'll smooth this over?
No. He said, no. He was... I can't remember exactly what he said, but he let it be known that, you know, he had my back, that he felt badly, but at that point, you know, he had his arms full with pushback for the president, and he wasn't going to get involved in something like that.
Right. Now, let's talk about the spring of Monica. When did you first meet Monica as a person? We'll talk about that. But when did you first find out there was a scandal? We forget the time frame. The scandal came to light, or the sexual contact came to light, months after it happened.
Years. It was
years.
January in 1998, and it was so scary. I remember coming into work on a Sunday. And I never worked on Sundays because it was like 8:30 and the phones were ringing off the hook. It wasn't just the White House press corps, but the news anchors were calling, like, what's going on? What's going on? And it really felt like the White House had been hit by a tsunami and that at any moment we could capsize. And I remember, you know, it's funny, tonight's the State of the Union. I remember the State of the Union that year and, you know, you just didn't know what was going to happen. And I knew that they had prepared a speech. The president was ready to deliver it. But we were all gathered in the chief of staff's office watching, and I remember thinking, you know, is he going to resign? You know, could this be the moment where he does it?
And before we get to how you knew Monica as a person, so this scandal hits. It remind me of the time frame, because if people have read about your book, there are two, the major attention your book has gotten are a couple blurbs, which is former White House intern you claims that she got hugged by President Clinton and some inappropriate contact with Vernon Jordan. Now, the Vernon Jordan contact, did that happen before the Monica Lewinsky scandal hit? When did that happen?
Well, that happened, say, when I was an intern.
Yeah.
So probably in the same time that, you know, the president and Monica were having their interactions.
And what, you needed him as a recommendation for a Rhodes Scholarship, and he took you out to dinner and treated it like a date? Tell me what happened.
But here's
there.
The thing. You know, ever since, you know, I was in high school, people have always been encouraging us, you know, you have to go out and you have to get mentors. And I really looked at Vernon Jordan as a dream mentor, someone who was really a change maker. And so I was excited when he paid attention to me. And so there were times when he did take me out for lunches and dinners. And what I write about is that there were few times when he'd greet me with a kiss on the lips, like a light kiss.
Yeah.
And for him, you know, maybe that was the most normal thing in the world, but he was 60 and I was 21, and it was really uncomfortable for me. So I write about, you know, dealing with that. But then also, you know, the thing is, the chapter's called Advice from Vernon Jordan, and he still gave me guidance, and he gave me a lot to think about. So even though the situation was tricky, I still felt that, you know, I got a lot out of my interaction with him.
Right. I think you talk about you had to ignore what was bearable, and that was bearable in order to advance in your career. So did you know Monica at all?
I knew her casually.
And what was your impression of her?
You know, it's funny. I thought of her as a nice person. Like, I thought of her as, you know, she was a pretty girl who had a big, effusive personality. Now, the thing is, in the West Wing, it's probably one of the most self-regulating environments that exists, that people are always paying attention to each other. Like who's trying to get too much of attention from the president, or who's making too big of a spectacle of themselves? And, you know, as young aides, we were always trying to be invisible, almost. And she was someone who seemed to break a lot of those unwritten
rules.
Yeah,
you know, from reading your book, it seems that you were starstruck, and I would say appropriately starstruck. These are the most important people in America. You were an intern. And yet, when you read about Monica Lewinsky's behavior, and this is not to blame the victim, from reading your book, it seems totally impossible that someone would flirt with the president, show her thong to the president, this stuff. So it seems like you and Monica were behaving, had the same job title, but were behaving in totally different ways.
You know, it's I would agree with that. And I think sometimes some behaviors are so outside of what you think is even possible for someone else to do, you don't even imagine that they could possibly do it. And the closest we'd seen her do something like that, you know, we have a story of, you know, one time she brought George a latte.
Yeah.
Now, that might seem like the most benign thing in the world. But to us, we were like, you know, she doesn't even know George, and she doesn't work for George, and she must have walked like 10 blocks. You know, back then, Starbucks wasn't everywhere.
Did you ever bring him a latte? Would you ever dare?
Only if I were asked.
Right. I want your reaction. You know, in 1996, James Carville said about Paula Jones, drag a $100 bill through a trailer park and you'll never know what you'll find. So what's your reaction to this sort of, what was the reaction to what they called the bimbo eruptions and to bat for political purposes, to beat back these charges? Sometimes, you know, some sexism was used as a defense mechanism. So what was your reaction to that?
You know, for a long time, it was easy to write off these charges. Like, any time a woman came forward, it was easy just to say, oh, it's politically motivated. Or, oh, you know, or to have this kind of classist way in a way to look at it, that, oh, you know, they're trash and this is what they're going to do. And for a very long time, it was easy just to write that off that way. And I think, you know, January 98, when the Monica stuff hit, for me, that really was a tipping point where I believed it from go, you know, because he knew he had this track record, and I knew that, you know, Vernon Jordan would help him. You know, he wouldn't even have to be asked. So, and I think it took a few years later to really think, for it to really sink in how awful it is, you know, when you do have prosecutors or you have defense attorneys, you know, who go after these women and go after their backgrounds to, you know, to try to tear them up so they won't talk.
Discredit them, yeah. The very first chapter in the book takes place in 2000. You were 23 by then, and was this your last contact with President Clinton?
No.
Okay, but there was you put it first, or at least I guess maybe your publisher suggested put it up front because it has the charge that everyone's talking about, or the incident. What happened? He hugged you on a balcony.
Well, what happened was is that you know, this is when I was doing advance work, and that means when the president travels ahead, there's a team of people who do the preparation, and I was working the Okinawa G8 trip in 2000. And my special job is that I took care of the hotel and I made sure everybody had the rooms they needed and what they needed in the rooms. And so on the last night, the president invited me into the suite. And at first, I'm thrilled because you're getting attention from the president. And no matter who you are, you know, your valet or your, you know, a five-star general, you're trying to get the man's attention.
Have you ever been in a room alone with him before?
Not only... there's been times when I was in George's outer office where he'd walk through, but not in this kind of situation. So for initially, it's, oh, that's great. But then very quickly, I realized, oh, this could go wrong very quickly. So he invited me on the balcony and we're talking. And it was very confusing. It was very scary because, again, you know that this could go wrong very quickly. And he hugs me. And the hug lasts a few beats too long. Now, usually you could just write this off as, you know, a hug that lasted too long. Yeah. Like, it shouldn't be a big deal. But the fact was, it's the President of the United States.
And the fact that it was Bill Clinton 2 years after the Monica scandal, and it's outside, and there are probably people taking pictures. Just very weird, I'm sure, to you.
Yeah, and it was a moment, like, I felt like I have to escape this as quickly as possible. You know, I'm worried that if anyone on the inside finds out, I'll be banned from the road. I won't be able to work anymore. And if anyone on the outside finds out, you know, you face worldwide humiliation. You know, we all saw what happened to Monica. As you say, you know, it was a year and a half after her impeachment. You know, no one wanted to go through what she went through or to be perceived as being willing to do what she did.
Right. And so what is your take on Bill Clinton today?
You know, I have such great respect for the man. I think when I left Washington, you know, people have asked me, were you cynical when you left? It's like, well, no, I wasn't cynical, but I had a greater respect for human nature. Like, some people who are the greatest achievers among us also have the greatest frailties. And, you know, for example, like, it was thrilling to watch him take charge in the way that he did with the Haiti response. So, you know, it's difficult. I think, you know, he's a challenging person. And, you know, you just want to see him because when he's out there doing great in the world, you know, no one does it better.
What do you do now?
Right now, I work on a Katrina oral history project. I've been involved with Katrina-related research projects for the last 4 years. I also assisted Columbia University Professor John Mutter as he's trying to create the most complete Hurricane Katrina deceased victims list.
I've been speaking with Stacey Parker Abb about her new memoir, Government Girl, Young and Female in the White House. It's published by Echo, which is an imprint of Harper. Stacey, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.